is our AFR exclusive podcast where we get to do deep dives into the issues that you care about most. And if you have a question or a comment or an issue or a topic or a guest that you really want to hear from or any of those things that you would like for us to cover here on demand, you can always reach me and my team with those suggestions, jenna@afr.net. And a lot of you actually since the inauguration and even before that, but especially after the inauguration and all of these executive orders that President Trump signed within the first 8 hours of his presidency, really want more of a deep dive into those executive orders and the overall strategy contemplation of the Trump administration. Are we going to see the fulfillment of campaign promises? What is this golden age that Trump is talking about? And what do we think? What should we think about the next Trump administration and the next 4 years? Has he learned some of the lessons in terms of personnel, policy, the swamp, and all of that from his first term? So I can think of none other better to join me for this conversation than Daniel Horowitz, who goes by the handle at RM Conservative on X. He's a senior editor at The Blaze, a writer, policy analyst, and also the host of CR Podcast. You can find that wherever you stream podcasts other than here at AFR, because this is our AFR exclusive. But Daniel, thanks so much for joining me to talk about this. And first, your overall thoughts on the second Donald Trump administration.
So it's great to be back with you, Jenna, and what a week it is. You know, first off, I just say one thing I'm happy about is at least we're talking about substance this week, a bunch of important issues, and that's good, you know, because all too often it's just soap opera and, you know, like, what are we here for? We're here to actually change things, life, liberty, property, economy, you know, culture, all that stuff. We got to change things. We all recognize that you come off of 4 years of what we experienced. There's a lot to do. So I'm very cautiously optimistic that there's a sense of urgency. You saw a lot more professionalism. It's tighter. It's less chaotic. They were much more prepared in terms of personnel and policies and ideas of what they wanted to do. So that was really good. Obviously, the devil's in the details in terms of what is an enduring victory. So, you know, this is our second go around, right? We have a first term, and you know, it's sort of like. For many years, Republicans try to get through this haunted house, and there's 20 different doors. And let's say it's door 7 and 8 that really give us a problem, and they always fail and get, you know, run out of the house screaming and scared. And you come in door 1 and 2, man, they're really killing it. And it's great. I couldn't do any better. But you're not yet at that point that really determines the long-term success. It's a 9-inning ball game, right? So you could do good in inning 1, inning 4, but it's ultimately what happens at the end. So, you know, how did we wind up with Biden? How did we wind up that we were worse off than we were ever before? The Trump's entire first term was washed away. Reagan has basically been washed away. The 94 Congress, the 2010 Tea Party. In other words, how do we change this cycle and finally get enduring victories? So, Jen, I'm giving that preface just because obviously it's easy to walk in such a radical administration, so repudiated, especially with those pardons at the end, gave him a free runway, do a bunch of executive orders. And I would say that first day was a 10 out of a 10. I wouldn't have, you know, fundamentally done anything different. It was great. But now the key is to convert them into enduring victories. Legislatively, budget-wise, obviously navigating the courts, and then, of course, making sure that we don't make any issue worse. So, you know, we don't spend more money, we don't add more to record immigration, we don't empower the transhumanist, globalist, you know, green energy cartel or tech bro cartel even more. You know, we could debate over how much you could accomplish, but you certainly don't want to go backwards on anything. So these are all things that we're going to have to navigate, but I think what I would say to top it off, and I'll stop this filibuster, the first week shows that, you know, there's a lot that we can work with. At the same time, there are a lot of competing voices, as there was during the first term, and our goal should be to empower the voices in the administration that are conservative and, you know, over some of the more special interest donor types.
Right. And, you know, to characterize this as an enduring victory, I think is 100% spot on, Daniel, because those kind of generational wins really matter so that we can continue to build upon that and build a moral and upright society rather than just have kind of these temporary executive orders or a temporary win. I mean, we saw, and I think everybody, even if they hated Trump in his first term, they couldn't deny the positive advantages and effects on their own pocketbook, for example, and just the state of the economy and America positioned on the world stage. I mean, all of that that then did get wiped away with the Biden administration, and we saw the weaponization of government, even the COVID vaccine mandates. That was just absolutely insane when you compare and contrast that with what liberty and freedom and informed consent should be. And so with the promise of America's golden age, as Trump has kind of set this up as, with the myriad of voices that are informing him, especially the tech bro element of this, and then really kind of the lack of addressing the COVID vaccine from Trump's administration. I had a listener this week also write in just saying, you know, hey, this has kind of gone by the wayside. You know, is Trump really going to do anything to ensure medical freedom and some of this? Where do you see perhaps the potential pitfalls where we need to remain the most vigilant?
Sure. So that's important. And I think, again, just realize that what we don't want to happen, because this did happen in the first administration, you could have a certain issue where you have good and bad, but the good falls away and the bad is enduring. And just remember, when you have bad under a Republican administration, it's even worse, because that is enduring. Because then you usually get it through Congress, it's bipartisan, so and then anyone else gets marginalized. Now, that's a typical Republican administration. I think we all agree that Trump has more clout on the right than Abraham Lincoln did in the Republican Party. So, you know, so that is a pitfall that you want to make sure that, A, the good things, we see them through, we see it through, we get it enduring, but that we don't have bad things. And we can't blind ourselves to the fact that, obviously, Trump himself is sometimes conflicted or on the wrong side of some issues. He has elements around him that are problematic, among a lot of very patriotic friends that we have in the administration. So I'd say some of the things we've already seen this week is, obviously, you know, I have made the case for a long time. Trump made the case 9 years ago, 10 million legal and illegal immigrants ago, that we had record high immigration. We need to bring immigration back to historic norms for culture and for the American worker. That has seemed to not only go by the wayside, but he's saying we need even more. So again, that is a pitfall. Obviously, the donor class is going to want more. You have the tech bros. You also have the Arab bros. There is Saudi money, Qatari money. You have his daughter's new father-in-law, who's a Lebanese billionaire. They're going to do everything they can to make sure that the orders that were implemented to get more vetting and limit immigration, but it didn't exactly say which countries it catalyzed the process, they're going to want to really limit that. We're going to want to expand it. So I think just in general, the mindset needs to be not like, you know, focus so much on Trump. It needs to be focused on the issue. We want our issues. It's not a matter of judging Trump. That's for God to do. That's for history to do. It's a matter of prospectively. There's a menu of opportunities here. The sky's the limit. The Democrats are destroyed. Trump has a bigger megaphone than the media. He has a bigger media empire than the media, than the mainstream media. He could use a bully pulpit and a veto pen to get a lot done. But it's a matter of what you want to get done. So we want reductions, not increases in immigration. Spending, obviously, is a huge one. I mean, everything since he's taken office, every proposal is to add to the deficit. There's not a single major proposal that will significantly cut spending yet. So we need to see that through, because here's the problem. you could do a lot of good things in this admin. Foreign policy, let's say immigration, let's say, you know, regulatory reform, transformational things. And that would be great. In any other era, that would be enough. The problem is inflation is so crushing now. If we don't cut the interest on the debt and the printing needed to service that, what's going to happen is what threw out Biden is going to throw out Republicans. And again, like we talked about, it's just going to wash that all away. So you've got to have a strategy of getting inflation under control, and I'm not really seeing that yet. So it's just to go back to immigration for a minute, if let's say Trump pushes to end birthright citizenship, but the courts strike it down, and then but then concurrently he pushes a deal of like some nebulous border security that we don't even need a bill in Congress for, in return for DACA and increased H-1B. Well, what are we going to wind up with? You don't get the good, but you get the bad. Mm. Now, I don't blame him for what the courts are going to do, but you see what I mean? That's how you got to see this through. And then this whole, like, gosh, I don't know how to say it, this Stargate $500 billion investment. I mean, I'm not categorically opposed to it, but I'd like to know, where is the money coming from? And if it's all private, then, you know, what exactly is he doing? Right, you don't announce every merger on Wall Street every day at a presidential level. So clearly there is some governmental facilitation there, you know, to build these massive data centers, AI centers in rural America, suck up a lot of energy, a lot of land, a lot of rezoning. This is the sort of Agenda 2030 transhumanist thing that we would have yelled under Biden. I understand there is a desire to compete with China on AI, and that's a legitimate thing, but we also have to weigh this and understand what this is. So I think we need to understand better where that's coming from. But to get back to your mRNA and medical freedom thing, this Larry Ellison guy, the Oracle CEO, literally got up there and said, and we're going to have mRNA technology, and we're going to detect cancer. And it's like, there's a lot of informed consent problems with that. These people don't believe in what we believe in. They don't see any problem with what happened with COVID. And all those guys have now been empowered. And, like, the mRNA technology, you could say it was a good theory at the beginning, but clearly it's not just the COVID shots. The technology is problematic. And I'm just a little bit surprised at how suddenly that's not a problem. So, you know, my thing is this. Anything that we would have had a problem with 3 minutes ago shouldn't suddenly change, if you know what I mean. Now, you could say that, look, Trump is doing good on 10 issues, so, yeah, you'll win some, you lose some, I'm fine. But don't tell me that urine is water, okay? Don't go out of your way and tell me, oh, actually, you know, I want more immigration, I want more spending, I want mRNA is not a problem. You know, again, it's not a matter of for or against Trump. Or for against DeSantis, for against whatever Republican is there. We have to be advocates for our prerogatives. We are our only advocates, and we have to guard that very carefully.
Absolutely. And I think all of the contrasts that you just mentioned, and to be optimistic but vigilant, this requires, I think, a complex understanding of what it genuinely means to be a principled conservative. And I hope that that people, you know, whether or not they were for Trump in the primary, the general, you know, whatever, principled conservatives will hope that he succeeds. And measuring success, yes, though, is not about just Trump getting what Trump wants, but Trump being faithful to the principles of conservatism. So what would you set up right now as kind of the goalpost and the metric or plumb line, or, you know, whatever the analogy is, of measuring success in the Trump administration? Because we know the media is going to say he failed on everything, and we know that Trump's, you know, spokespeople will say he succeeded on everything. So where is the plumb line of truth?
You know, like I said, the first thing is we have to make sure we are not lending the weight of Trump and his movement to left-wing things and making things worse. You know, because we're going to debate narrow majorities. What could you accomplish? Well, for sure, we shouldn't gratuitously add more immigration, more spending, empower some of these globalists even more. That for sure, there's no reason we need to be doing that. So to me, first off, is that no issue that we complained about beforehand are we making worse? Okay, we saw that a little bit with that Israel deal that, you know, I mean, look, Biden offered that same thing, 33 hostages in exchange for 1,900 terrorists and pulling out of Gaza and handing it back to Hamas. We cried bloody murder back then, but now it's, I guess it's good. So, you know, I mean, like, we have to understand that a politician is someone that you, a horse you ride to a fixed destination. They don't ride you to oblivion. And that's true of anyone. You could have a certain amount of benefit of the doubt, a little bit more grace for one person over another or one party over another, but that has to be limited. And I think from our metric is the things that we said we didn't want the last 4 years, what is the trajectory of that? And like I said, you can't measure by one day or one week, right? Because, you know, let me give you immigration, for example. Trump got in there, and just the perception, remember, illegal immigration is not about physically removing every person and spending $1 trillion. They're sentient beings. They're not potted plants. They respond to logical incentives and disincentives. You make it clear that we're going to cut off the work and the magnets and you can't be here, they leave. If you make it clear that we're going to continue this kind of wink and nod, like it's legal, but hey, we need your labor, so come in, then they'll come. It's that simple. Just his election in 2017, the numbers went down to like 11 to 14,000 apprehensions a month, the lowest since 1969. But then, you know, there were good executive orders, again, a similar thing. But then over time, and, you know, some of it was not his fault, but some of it could have been dealt with better. You had the Ninth Circuit, you had the courts, you had the sanctuary cities, and then they, you know, started coming back in. And then we had what was actually the biggest invasion to date in 2019. We were getting 100,000 a month. Whole entire families coming in. And honestly, it was mainly COVID that really shut it down. Ken Cuccinelli, when he was at DHS, he implemented Return to Mexico, other things that started to help. It was pretty bad. So, and then, you know, he lost, Biden came in, and then just, you know, biblical levels. So again, 8 years later, you know, you were worse than ever before. It wasn't enduring. So that's what I mean. We have to watch for that. The first day is always going to look amazing. The first week is going to look amazing. What a contrast. But we have to remember that to say it's better than Biden is not enough, because too many people make the mistake, in my point of view, of constantly focusing on a snapshot in history, right? Just freeze frame. Ed, it's better than the Democrats. Oh, man, thank God we didn't get the Democrat. Thank God we didn't get Harris. The problem is, no, you will get it, and you'll get it even worse, whether it's 4 or 8 years. Since the Civil War, there's one thing that is always true, the pendulum swings. Whether it's 4 or 8, one party is not in power longer than that. Okay, it goes back and forth, and it will go back and forth no matter who your Republican president is. That's just a reality. The question is, over a 10 to 20-year window, what are you seeing? And what we have seen until now in our life is that the demographics get worse, the budget gets worse, the dependency gets worse, the culture gets worse, the freedom erodes, and the left seems to, in the long run, always endure. Like Obamacare endured. It destroyed health care, a sixth of the economy. It's unaffordable. It's horrible. COVID was really a bastard child of Obamacare in many, many respects with the monopolies that it created. They endure. What is our Obamacare? What is our big picture that we want to endure? That's what we need to understand. The Democrats are going to come back, and commensurate with how good Trump is and bold he is, that we want him to be bold. Just remember, everyone's like, oh my gosh, that first day. Well, that's great. but you understand what the next Democrat president's first day is going to look like. And this leads me, Jenna, to my final point, which is why we need to change the party to get better people down ballot in red state governments. Why do we only have one DeSantis and not 20 of them? Okay, here's the thing. Do you know what doesn't swing back and forth between Republican and Democrat? At least 20 states. Republicans are always going to hold them. So you don't have to worry about being washed away. I'm just going to give you a baseline concern here. Right now, the Freedom Caucus is down to 31 people. The Main Street Caucus, which is the rhinos that are to the left of leadership, are up to 80. They keep growing. They're growing and growing. Trump has got to get better with endorsements, and there's got to be pressure applied to stop endorsing people that the base hates and says they want to get rid of, but then somehow Trump endorses them and, you know, we don't change anything. So what I don't want is an outcome. Let's say Trump is the best he could have ever been, but then endorses a bunch of rhinos for governor. So, for example, there's this woman, Robeson, who's a big rhino in Arizona, hated Trump. For some reason, no one can figure this out. He came out of the gate after this election, 2 years ahead of time, endorsing her for governor. Well, Andy Biggs, who was a former Freedom Caucus chairman, congressman, one of the most conservative members of Congress, very close with Trump, by the way, he wants to run for governor. I mean, don't we want that? Yet if Trump persists in his endorsement of this woman, she will win. I'm just going to tell you that right now. She will win. Whoever Trump endorses will win. He has more clout now than he's ever had, and he's always influenced the primary. So, Jenna, imagine if we wind up a situation like this. Trump does amazing things, let's say, best case scenario. But then inevitably the Democrats are going to come in. It's very unlikely inflation will go down anyway, so that in itself makes it even more likely. They'll probably win back the House in 2 years. And all that's washed away overnight. We up the ante in what we do. Now they'll up the ante even more in what they do executively. So what are we left with? Our red states. You know, look, I mean, Jenny, you've been a victim of this. You know exactly what the next Democrat presidency is going to bring with it. Just the weaponization and persecution of political opponents alone. You're not even going to need a pretext of, oh, you yelled some profanities outside of the Capitol on January 6th. They'll just come straight after you. You're going to want red state sanctuaries where you have people that are going to block that. But what if we're left with a bunch of Trump rhino endorsements that now we have a bunch of chambercrats sitting there? So now you have the Democrats are back. They will be back. There's no question about that. And now you have no sanctuary to go to. You see what I mean? To me, just the endorsement of rhinos in red states is worse than outweighs any good you'll do federally, because we're a divided country, and unfortunately, most of that gets washed away. So this is just a perspective. I want people to harness this moment where it feels so good, but have a different mentality. Don't sit back and relax. We need to make enduring victories, and in order to do that, you can't just sit back passively and be like, whatever Trump does is good. You can't do that with anyone. We should never be that way. But certainly with someone that, look, even the biggest fan, if you have some shred of right-leaning, whatever you want to call it, conservative-based, populist, whatever word you want to use, whatever you are, I think, you know, I'm not reinventing the wheel here, that there are ideological problems. There are, you know, donor, associate, staff problems. And you got to be vigilant, optimistic, but vigilant.
I think that admonishment and, frankly, exhortation is very well timed, Daniel Horowitz, because there is such a sense of relief and optimism and celebration right now, which is very good. And I think we're all very glad that we don't have a Kamala Harris administration right now that we're having to contend with. But we do need to ensure that we have these kinds of enduring wins, and that we really understand what it means to build upon them. And the last question I have for you then is, you know, we have the Republican trifecta, but we've seen how Republicans, when they are in the minority, just say, well, we can't do anything but sort of vocally oppose and strongly worded letters, whatever. But then when they are in the majority, the first 2 years with Paul Ryan as Speaker of the House, and of course, Mitch McConnell as Senate Majority Leader, actively opposed Trump's agenda. They stymied the whole America First movement, were rhinos, literally Republicans in name only. And now it seems like with the new composition of Congress, Speaker Johnson has at least said that he wants to be America First, but we haven't exactly seen that in practice. And Republicans as a whole seem to be so spineless and have this kind of false notion that even though they have this overwhelming mandate, they need to reach across the aisle and talk to the Democrat minority. I mean, we should just be marginalizing the heck out of them and just saying, you know, nothing of what you want actually matters because we have the numbers, we have the voters on our side. So we can literally forget that you are here and just pass through legislatively everything that we can in the next 2 years, hopefully 4 years, and build upon that. How confident, maybe, or cautiously optimistic are you that Republicans might actually get it together?
Not very. I mean, I'm not going to lie to you, and that's why most of the good stuff will get done executively. But again, whose fault is that? Whose prerogative is that? I mean, this is what I find very bizarre, Jenna, that on the one hand, everyone's like, Trump is king. I mean, he's the power, he has the bully pulpit. I mean, he could bulldoze anyone. All right. But then, so then what happened to the rhinos? There was a disturbing trend in the first term, and unfortunately it has continued so far, even worse. Trump's interaction with Congress is where things break down. That it seems like he pressures the Freedom Caucus to move to the left and not the Rhino Caucus to move to the right. Everyone's like, well, then you wouldn't have the votes because you lose a few. Well, I don't understand. Like, let's say birthright citizenship. Oh my gosh, we couldn't do that. Really? Why wouldn't Trump ground these guys into dust? Why is it only the Freedom Caucus that gets the pressure? Let me tell you how bad it is. The Main Street Caucus, again, which is to the left of leadership, which is a little bit bizarre why you'd want to create a caucus, like leadership's not liberal enough for you. But anyway, a bunch of new guys join. They don't seem to be, like, concerned that Trump's going to come after them. But I will tell you, there are people that the Freedom Caucus spent money electing, and one I know was a part of a state Freedom Caucus already in a legislature, and they're scared to join because of Trump. That is a problem. There is a pattern in Congress that you're allowed to be to the left of Trump in the party, but you're not allowed to be to the right of him, and that's concerning. You talk about Paul Ryan stymieing the agenda. The Freedom Caucus wanted to get rid of him. Trump endorsed him. How did they sign his agenda? Crappy budget bills. But who signed those budget bills? Trump. He didn't veto them. And in fact, Steven Mnuchin, his Treasury Secretary, negotiated them at the front end. I mean, Paul Ryan didn't stymie the agenda. I mean, the administration wanted that. I hope it changes, but that's going to take two things. But they're very big things he has. The bully pulpit and the veto pen. Okay, I want your listeners to remember that. The bully pulpit and the veto pen. And it can't be people like Chip Roy who actually want to cut immigration and cut spending. You know, kind of the mandate, kind of what we ran on for really, you know, in the case of immigration, really both times or all three times he ran. Why isn't it the Rhino Caucus that's like, we want to keep the Green New Deal. We don't want to cut any spending. We like wind and solar subsidies. Why don't they get the fist? Let me give you an example. Yesterday, Mike Johnson, Senator Tom Tillis, and Senator Cassidy, dude, those are two red state Republicans up for re-election this cycle, and they're problematic on many issues. They all kind of ripped Trump's pardons of the J6ers, you know, not understanding what violence means and who is, you know, sentenced to what. And again, like, it struck me at how openly they could attack Trump from the left, knowing that they're not going to raise the ire. You know what I mean? Like, Joni Ernst was, for a while, holding up his nominees, and Trump never called her out. But Chip Roy got, like, the full treatment, if you know what I mean. Why? I want your audience to think about that. Why? It's a little bit perturbing because there's not a single rhino who's been threatened with a primary. How do you drain the swamp if you don't drain the swamp? Again, like, the Freedom Caucus lost seats. The left-wing caucus gained seats. And there's a reason for that. And there were a lot of open seats where you had a rhino caucus guy and then someone who was maybe Freedom Caucus, or even if he wasn't, but definitely to the right. And Trump endorsed the guy to the left. And it wasn't like a Harris district where, like, oh, well, maybe you need a guy like that. No, I mean, these are very red districts. Why? Why? I mean, this is something that really does bother me. I think you're going to see a lot of good executively. But he needs to take that clout to Congress and direct it to where it needs to be directed with the bully pulpit and say, we have a mandate. We need to do this. He could overpower the media. Certainly, if you're a Republican, you have no leg to stand on opposing him. So why is that not used against the left goalpost of the party? I'm trying to figure that out. And then obviously there's the veto pen. And I keep hearing this business, well, we don't have 60 seats. In the Senate, we have a narrow majority in the House. Well, Jenna, do you know who else doesn't have 60 seats? The Democrats. So when you have budget bills, when you have reauthorization bills, you know, people think like, oh, well, we need to affirmatively pass something to change things, right? And if we don't have the vote, we can't do it. Yeah, but here's the problem with that. A lot of people forget that as much as there's a lot of problems with our government, most of the programs and agencies actually do sunset. Their authorization, some are 10 years, some are 5, but some are 3 or 1. And they do sunset. And a lot of those, I don't have a list in front of me, there's a lot of, think of like FBI reauthorization, right? So if you want that reauthorized, you need to get a bill passed through all, you know, House, Senate, and President to sign. Like, the president could say, I will let this lapse. I will not sign it if you don't have a baseline of these reforms, maybe a couple others we could negotiate down. I'm not going to get everything I want, but you sure as heck are not going to get everything you want. Use the bully pulpit with that veto pen. I think people forget that. Now, yeah, it depends on the issue. Like, if we were like, we're going to abolish all of Social Security and Medicare, well, then I would assume we're not going to have much leverage with the public on that. But a lot of what we want to do, most of what we want to do, the Democrats are repudiated. The public's not with them. Okay? So, for example, you know, let's say Democrats are like, we're not signing a budget bill unless you, overturn your executive orders on birthright or, funding the WHO or something. We want to fund the WHO. Oh my gosh! Well, we're gonna have a government shutdown, or we don't have the votes. They don't have the votes. Trump needs to go around and say, use the bully pulpit. These SOBs are saying that even prospectively, they want to break into the country illegally and steal, unilaterally assert jurisdiction, and steal citizenship for a baby, right? Prospectively. That's nuts. No one's going to side with that. You see what I mean? I mean, we're always like, he's king. He defeated the media. He has the corporate. He has tech. He has it. All right, so then use it. You're right. But then when it comes to legislative budgetary debates, it's like, oh, man, you don't understand. Like, the Democrats, we don't have power. I'm sick of that bull crap. I'm sick of that. We got to grow in this. We got to change in that. I understand we're not going to get everything we want in every issue, but it's got to improve, and we can't afford otherwise. Mm.
Well, Daniel Horowitz, I know you've stayed longer than we originally anticipated, and I so appreciate your time and your deep dive on this. And, you know, just last question then for my listeners who are all saying, yeah, I get this, and I want this to change. I want to have these enduring wins, and I get it. I'm optimistic for Trump, but I want to encourage his administration and Congress especially to do all of these things. What are some practical action items for the person, you know, just maybe sitting at home thinking, well, okay, you know, I get it, but what can I do other than the closed universe of just voting for the options that I'm given and voting the best that I can? But can I really affect change in some of these areas?
Well, obviously, when you talk about voting, I mean, primaries are more important than general elections in my mind. I mean, you see that. And, you know, you can't have it both ways. You can't say, well, it's not Trump's fault, even though he's the king of the party. It's the rhino's fault. Okay, so then get rid of them. But then, you know, we go and support them. So, you know, you can't change the party if you don't change the party. And, in fact, to the extent it's changing, it's actually moving to the left. And I could give you metrics, and I just did. Last cycle was horrendous. So you got to start now with recruitment. If you don't have someone affirmatively fighting for you, whether Freedom Caucus or maybe a few other members, they don't want to cut spending, okay? They don't want to cut immigration, and even on illegal immigration, a lot of them are kind of like wink and nod. They talk about the border, but honestly, they want the cheap labor, and, you know, they're still there. And you have to look inside. If you're in a red state, red district, do you really see your member fighting for you? And if not, you could do better. And then again, I just say you got to focus on the legislative sessions are heating up now, the first part of the year. And remember, as much as you feel you have a mandate in Washington, my gosh, if you're in a 3-1 Republican state, the mandates, the sky's the limit. And don't accept low expectations. You follow it. Call them. Make the play calls. I want you to vote for this bill. I want you to vote against it, both your congressman, but also state legislator. And then most of the red state governorships will be up in the midterms. That's when they're up. And we can't continue electing these WEF, transhumanist, wind energy supporting, mRNA supporting Republican governors, which they are. Almost every Republican governor is liberal. It's just a reality. And we got to do better. We got to do better. And I'm telling you, in Arizona, we have a, you know, if Andy Biggs goes through with it, you have one of the best ones running against a big liberal. And I don't understand. Like, we're all for cutting spending, but it's someone else's spending, not mine. We're all for cutting immigration, but someone else's immigration. We're all for getting rid of rhinos, but someone else's rhinos. And this is how we wind up not changing anything. So, you know, again, my view is Trump could lean in better because he does lean in, but really in the other direction. But if we don't want to talk about that, then at least, you know, get rid of these guys. But we have Tom Tillis, Bill Cassidy, Joni Ernst. They're up from red states. They're horrible. They're full-spectrum liberals. I'm sorry. Fiscal and social. All three of them, actually. I think all three of them voted to mandate gay marriage in red states, if I remember correctly. I mean, like, dude, something's got to change.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think all of that is excellent advice and, you know, optimism, but vigilance. And we've got to seek out enduring wins, be engaged in the primaries, and be engaged in the policies that matter, and very, you know, pro success, but on a measurement and metric that's aligned with conservative principles. I mean, all of these things, Daniel Horowitz, yep. I think are so incredibly important. And the wisdom that you share, I really appreciate you doing this deep dive today. And I hope it's been as beneficial for listeners as it has been for me. I think it's a great overview and also a deep dive. So really appreciate it. And again, you can listen to Daniel Horowitz at the CR podcast. And he's also a senior editor at The Blaze. You can follow him on X at RM Conservative. Has some of the best takes and commentary you will see on the trash bin that's on fire of X and the political Twitter, as it's still kind of called, even though it's now named X. But thanks so much, Daniel Horowitz. And you're listening to On Demand with Jenna Ellis. And if you have a question or a topic that you would like us to do a deep dive in, or a guest that you'd like to suggest, you can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. And we drop these every Friday for your benefit. You can also tune in to Jenna Ellis in the Morning. That is our daily morning broadcast to start the day with all of the news and commentary that you need to know. And make sure that you have downloaded our app so that you can stream that and other AFR broadcasts from anywhere. So go to Apple or Android or wherever you are, get our AFR app, and I will see you next week here on Demand.